Mariachi Portland, Conjunto Alegre y Rafa de Alaska y su Deadliest Catch Band. Ven por los muertos y quédase a la comida, bebida y baile. Patrocinado en parte por KBOO, Tequila Cuervo y Cover Organ. Visita Facebook Muertos Northwest.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Up next is the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this October 28th Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, we'll talk minimum wage, revolutionary practice, capitalism, and board games, and eight girls taking pictures. We'll open this morning's show with Bill Riznick talking with Trish Kozla. She's an activist in the Fight for 15 movement, minimum wage college graduate worker, and she has recently written an article for JacobinMagazine.com titled Beyond Fast Food Strikes, Why the Left Shouldn't Write Off Low-Wage Strikes. Trish Kozla describes herself as a revolutionary socialist, history grad student, low-wage worker, union organizer, chant leader extraordinaire, and she's unapologetically fighting for a $15 an hour wage and a union. And she's currently at the University of Chicago and a member of the Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago. Larry Bolden, our book mole, will review Whitney Otto's 2012 novel, Eight Girls Taking Pictures. Otto, who now lives in Portland, is best known for her novel, How to Make an American Quilt. Eight Girls Taking Pictures is based on half a dozen women photographers whose lives spanned the 20th century. And in her author's note, Whitney Otto describes the book as, quote, a work of fiction inspired by several real women photographers whose lives and work have influenced my own. In the second half of our program, Old Mole Jan Hawken interviews Bill Ayers. He's a retired professor in the College of Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Most commonly known as a co-founder of the Weather Underground, Bill Ayers has dedicated his life and work to social justice movements, education reform, and curriculum development. He has a new book, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident, and describes his chaotic life after he and wife Bernadine Dorn became the topic and target of a conversation during Barack Obama's first run for the presidency. Discussion will focus on how Ayers takes up criticisms from the left on the Weatherman strategy of sabotage, going underground, armed resistance to the state, and what is to be learned from those failed strategies for radical politics today. And we'll close today's show with a well-read read from Clayton Morgridge, taking up the essay by Cliff Durand, Recreating Democracy in a Globalized State. Clayton compares and contrasts the principles of U.S. capitalism against the rules, strategies, and objectives of the Parker Brothers game Monopoly. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. You can find the Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks to those who have supported KBOO and the Old Mole recently during our membership drive. And now we will turn to Bill Riznick and Trish Kozla.
Thanks, Denise. Trish Kozla, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me on.
Trish, Trish Kosler is an activist in the F-15 movement, that is, fight for a $15 minimum wage. She also is a history student at the University of Chicago and wrote an article in the online journal Jacobin on F-15. A week ago, F-15 had its first major action at in Portland at a McDonald's place on Powell. It was sponsored by SEIU Local 53, also Jaws with Justice, and also the Portland Student Union with a big contingent from nearby Cleveland High School. They were very welcome. Trish Kosler, you're not alone, indeed far from it. Tell us about F-15 and how and why you got involved in Chicago.
Yeah, so we had been trying to organize at my workplace. I work at Whole Foods, and we really were having a difficult time because people were very scared about sort of the risk-to-benefit ratio, right? They were scared they were going to lose their jobs and not really get anything in return. But when Fight for 15 started in Chicago here, it started last Black Friday, with a civil disobedience action and a banner drop inside a Loop retail store. And that got people very excited because it made them feel like it wasn't just them in their store, but rather we were part of a movement. And so we organized for the April 24th strike, and after that, my coworkers have just been much more convinced to join in on organizing.
Uh-huh. How did you get involved in F-15? Look, give us a little sense of your history.
Well, I moved to Chicago to go to graduate school, and I have to work in order to support myself. So we're upset with our working conditions. At Whole Foods, it's especially over an attendance policy that fires a lot of really good workers. And we went to the Fight for 15 organizers, and we said, we want to be part of this movement. How can we get involved? And they were really excited to have us and, basically said, all right, well, you know, come to the – we have weekly union meetings that involve workers from all across the city. We debate strategy. And so for us, it was really a matter of just kind of showing up one day and being like, we think we found the right place to be.
Uh-huh. And in Chicago you've got this recent history of just extraordinary labor activism and labor activism that reaches out to the community and reaches out to the whole this huge number of increasingly low-waged workers in the U.S. economy. Tell us about recent Chicago and your involvement.
Yeah, so the Chicago Teachers Union strike was inspirational and a lesson for all workers in Chicago. At my store, everyone supported the teachers. It was one of those really polarizing things in the city where it was you were either on the side of the teachers or you were on ROM's side, and the majority of people, almost 70%, according to the polls that were taken, were on the side of the teachers.
ROM was so, Rahm Emanuel, right?
The
mayor.
Sorry, he's just like, that's pretty much what we call the devil out here in North Chicago. He's very widely hated. You don't even have to say his whole name.
Mayor 1% is I believe, one of the things he's called.
Oh, yes. That's one of the nicer words for it.
Uh-huh.
And so the teachers really did an amazing thing where they said, you know, this isn't just about us. It's not just about the pay freeze we were forced to accept a few years ago. This is about the schools Chicago students deserve. This is about having smaller class sizes. This is about foreign language classes. It's about arts and music in schools. This is about parents having a meaningful say over their children's education, about having good neighborhood schools for all kids. And so in doing that, they got the entire community involved, whether it was there was a parents coalition called Parents for Teachers, the Chicago Teacher Solidarity Campaign, which I was part of. And so every morning I went down to the picket line at the school close to my house, which is Farragut Vocational High School, and just getting to talk with the teachers, seeing the teachers, like, democratically debate their contract. You know, the teachers voted to stay out on strike so they would actually have a chance to read the contract before they voted whether or not to go back to work. It was a lesson in not just having a union just to fight the boss, but what kind of union you need to fight the boss. And me and low-wage workers all across Chicago You know, we saw them flood downtown. I mean, I remember when we went downtown the first day, we marched from my neighborhood about 2 miles to downtown, and there was, I mean, you couldn't move. Like, I never saw the front or the end of the march the whole day. We walked right under a train as it was going overhead. We couldn't even hear the train because we were so loud. And that was just, it was an expression of power in the workplace that people of my age had never really experienced. And it was a very powerful week of our lives.
Tell us also, you're just not a low-wage worker now. You've spent really, I gather, much of your life in low-waged work, working your way through college, trying to get a decent job after you graduated, and now deciding, I suppose, that you need a graduate degree ever to get a decent job, but still supporting yourself with a variety of low-wage jobs. Tell us about that, but also the people you've met, the so many precarious workers, so much insecurity, anxiety, lack of medical care, and hungry children.
Right. So, I mean, I have kind of switched industries as I've gone about, but every job I've ever had has been a low-wage job. So I started out as a farm worker, and I worked my way on farms across western North Carolina. And there it was not just was low-wage, but it was very rampant wage theft in terms of, like, I would go sometimes months without ever actually receiving a paycheck. And so a lot of the coworkers I had there were mostly Latino immigrants. And so it really taught the importance of building solidarity and having good relationships with your coworkers and standing up to anti-immigrant policies. And then I thought, well, I can get a better job as a veterinary technician. And so I got a job as that, was laid off very quickly because our clinic downsized after the recession. Then was unemployed for almost a year. I worked part-time as a landscaper, but was forced to work cutting down trees with no safety equipment and having to do it with handsaws. And was paid by the job rather. So she said, you know, oh, it will take you 2 hours, but then it really took me five. I would still only get paid for 2 hours. When I started at Whole Foods, this was really my first time being in sort of an indoor workplace that was more than a few people. And that was very important in terms of seeing just the huge number of people who are in my situation. And just within my union, the stories we hear, like, I'm single, I'm fairly young, I don't have a lot of health issues. And so while it's very difficult for me to get by on these wages, it is easier than my coworkers who have kids. And so, for example, one of my coworkers is a single mother. Her son wants to go to a selective enrollment high school, but she's worried he will get shot on his way to school because he lives in Chicago's South Side. And so, but she can't afford to move to the neighborhood where the school is. And so he's stuck going to a school that doesn't have the programs he wants. Another one of my coworkers has a child that has digestive issues. And they can't afford to get the right kind of food for their kid, and so the kid is always sick. And, you know, other people, I mean, like last winter I had to decide, you know, okay, well, am I going to buy food this month or am I going to pay for my heating bill? And so I went for a good portion of the Chicago winter without heat. And these are the kind of decisions we have to make every day. Another one of my coworkers has to get water from her next-door neighbor in a bucket because she can't afford to keep her water on.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Chris Kahzle. Her name is spelled K-A-H-L-E. If you want to find her recent article on Jacobin, it's a web-only journal. It's getting a lot of notice for its combination of hard-hitting critique, but also reports on the rising of discontent and anger and movements amongst working people. Chris Kahzle, tell us about we've been talking so far about partly her experience as a working person and in the movements in Chicago, and particularly now the movements for a $15 minimum wage. It's called F-15. It's just begun here in Portland, Oregon. What do you see as the possibilities that this movement has staying power, that it's going to institutionalize, maybe institutionalize more than the Occupy movement of a little more than a year ago. Tell us about those possibilities. So far, I mean, it's embryonic now. It rises in many cities. It's just a demonstration or two, and often organized by SEIU or the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, both who are active, sometimes in action at Walmart. But is it catching on is the question. In Chicago, it appears to be.
Yeah, I think there's a couple really important points to make about this question, in the sense that I think it's catching on in a national way, in the sense that on August 29th, there were demonstrations in 62 cities, but out of that, only 35 of those were actually planned in terms of those other 30 cities were people seeing what was going on, being like, I want to participate in this. I've had enough. I want to walk out of my workplace. And so people went on strike in places like I've never even heard of, places SEIU organizers have never even been. And that presents a real challenge because especially in places like the South, the infrastructure for union organizing does not exist, and it's very difficult. And so those workers really need our support in terms of, you know, teaching them the lessons of unionism, supporting them as they go and try to join and organize. And I think that speaks to really what we have here in Chicago, because Chicago is in some ways unique because we have the example of the teachers in more than like you saw it on the news or something, but in a very tangible, like we learned lessons from them by going down and like some people in my neighborhood, which is I live in a majority Mexican neighborhood. So there were the mothers in the building next to me would bring tamales down to the school every day for the teachers. And just in terms of actually taking control of the workplace and seeing it as like we are actually in a battle with whether it's with Rahm Emanuel or with our bosses, like there is actually we have to fight. And if we fight, we actually have the potential to win. But here in Chicago, we also have we've taken that a step further in the sense that like it goes beyond what you see every day. So like in addition to the strikes on like August 29th, here we had a two-day strike, July 31st and August 1st, and then April 24th. It's also like we have now worker-led trainings on, for example, what does it mean to have a union every day? Because most people that I work with have never been in a union. Their family members were not in unions for a good portion of them. And so they don't really, like, they don't have an idea of what it means. Okay, so we went out on strike, but now what does that mean that we do every day on the shop floor? And we have in our city very experienced trade unionists who come and they teach us about organizing. We take the lessons of history. So we read, for example, at my workplace, we read a pamphlet by Dana Cloud, a labor historian, about the Woolworth sit-down strikes of 1937. And people were like, wait, you can occupy your workplace? That's such a great idea. So it's something we're having to learn from the ground up. But here in Chicago, we have a lot of support. And I think from trade unionists around the city, from community organizations, and we need to figure out how to translate that into similar things in every other city to start building up the rank and file organization in the workplace that's going to give the campaign the staying power it needs.
You know, for the old Mole Variety Hour, our radio, our show, we try and talk about the we call it the continuation of the great democratic revolution of the last 200 to 300 years, which was so jump-started and inspiring in the 60s, which continues to inspire people. But it seems to me that one of the themes, a major activity at least, and a goal of ours, not just this radio show, but of the international left, is to remain democratic in our operations and in our vision of the future. That is an authentic democracy where working people, in fact, are making the decisions that are participating in the decisions that shape all our collective lives, in gross distinction to this society, which is a really top down on anything important and excludes people actually even from thinking about important issues. that has to be built, though, in movements, a taste for that, the skills of it, the understanding of the possibilities of that. I understand that there's an effort in Chicago and, of course, other places across the country to incorporate those ideas in organizing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also in Chicago, a big influence was the occupation of the Madison Capitol, or the Wisconsin State Capitol in Madison,
right,
in 2011. A lot of people in the city went up there to support people in the Capitol. And so, for example, a worker at a coffee shop that we've been organizing with, she works at Pete's Coffee and Tea and was unjustly fired for being, she was late for the third time in a 12-month calendar period when she starts at 4:45 in the morning. And so she said, I know, I was asking her, like, what made you political? What really started you in organizing when she had never done any of this before? And she said for her it was actually going to the Capitol and seeing that, first of all, she was not alone in thinking that working people needed a bigger say in how things were done, but also that she saw, like, in embryo in that Capitol building, that people really, working people could run society, and that we actually were capable of making decisions for ourselves, whatever politicians may say. And that was it was a similar experience to what I had. I actually went to the Capitol as well, and it was really transformative to see these ideas about social democracy, about workers' collaboration, actually being put into practice in a way that felt extremely tangible. For it was just like a microcosm of what the world could be like in that Capitol. And I think similarly during the teacher strike, that we had very similar a similar experience here in Chicago in terms of, part of learning trade unionism for us has been learning democracy, because democracy at work is something that nobody has. Even many unionized workers don't have meaningful democracy at work. And so the teachers really in Chicago, through the core caucus, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, have really taken back this idea that you don't just need trade unionism, you need democratic unionism, you need rank and file, bottom-up unionism. And that's what we've been really trying to get from the get-go in ours. So when we organize new workers, we don't just want them to sign a card. We also want them to be like, okay, we need you now to participate in the union meetings because you are the union. We together, what we do, are the union. And having a contract would never even help us if we don't have the organization and democratic power to enforce it.
Trish Kozla, thanks so much for talking to us today. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And keep struggling the good work at Whole Foods and, in fact, across Chicago. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I got a job making money for the man. Throw a chicken in a bucket with a soda pop can. Cute cream in the fall on my back. I had to set it on fire in the Nevada chicken fat. I leaped on the counter like a bird with no hair. Running through the many mall in my underwear. I got lost downtown, couldn't find a ride home. Got frozen to the bone till a hooker let me share a paper coat. As I took a little nap, the cops picked up the spoon. I tried to explain, I was only trying to get warm. I knew I never ever should have burned my uniform. He said, too bad, but I'm like a bullet hard slut. I didn't have the teeth, so I stole his gun. And I crawled out the window with my shadow and a spoon. Dancing on the roof, shooting holes in the moon.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Denise Morris. Joe Clement is our engineer this morning. In the second half of our show, we'll hear Old Mole Jan Hocken interview Bill Ayers about his new book, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. That'll be followed by our well-read red for today, Clayton Morgridge, who will be talking about the contrast and comparisons between U.S. capitalism and the Parker Brothers game, Monopoly. But next up, we have book mole Larry Bolden. He reviews Whitney Otto's 2012 novel, Eight Girls Taking Pictures.
Good morning. As you readers know, we are fortunate to have many fine writers in the Northwest, and in particular in Portland. Today, I want to talk to you about one of these local authors, Whitney Otto, and her 2012 novel, Eight Girls Taking Pictures. I was fortunate to have been given the chance to read most of this ambitious book in an early draft form, and then to read it again in its published form. For the second reading, I adopted a method of reading that had been suggested to me by a colleague and fellow reader, Tony Wolk. He and I are both nearly fierce admirers of the Canadian writer Alice Munro. When Munro came out with her last collection of stories, Dear Life, Tony and I both bought it immediately. Knowing of my love for her, Tony asked me if I had immediately gobbled it up, and I confessed that I had read it all over the course of a day or two. When I turned the same question on him, he answered that he was allowing himself only one story at a time, forcing himself to read some other book between each story. I recalled having treated certain desserts like that as a child, and rather regretted not having employed a similar delaying or drawing out strategy in my own reading. Thus, when I got my copy of Eight Girls, I decided to read just one section about one photographer at a time. Besides wanting to savor the stories, I had also noticed in my quicker reading of the early draft the lives and stories of the women had run together, and I wanted to keep them distinct. I'm glad I decided on this method, if for no other reason than that it did prolong the treat. Since I've also heard Whitney talk about the writing of the book, I know that she did extensive reading of her own on many of the women photographers discussed, as well as a lot of historical accounts of the times in which they lived. As she says in the author's note at the end, quote, "This book is a work of fiction inspired by several real women photographers whose lives and work have influenced my own," close quote. While I appreciate the author's cautionary warning, it is obvious that she knows so much about these women and that she loves them for the struggles they went through in order to do their art. I'm impressed not only by her understanding of the lives of the women, but also her incredible grasp of the historical events that shaped their lives in the course of events in the last century. While this book could not have been written without the imaginative skill of the author, neither would have been the fascinating and comprehensive book it is without the extensive knowledge the author has of these historical figures. The lives of the eight women span all of the 20th century, and the constant theme of the stories is the incredible struggle it was for them to do their art in the context of the predominantly sexist climates of the time in which they grew up. The first six stories are based squarely on the lives and works of six real-life photographers, Imogene Cunningham, Madame Yvonda, Tina Madotti, Lee Miller, Greta Stern, and Ruth Orkin, and are presented in that order, although the names of the women are changed. The last two stories are based on actual photographs, but the two characters are created by Whitney Otto. Most of the eight women had progressive fathers or partners who encouraged them to act on their talents and passion, but nevertheless, trying to balance their lives as daughters, spouses, mothers, and artists was more than simply daunting. Even had Whitney Otto not set out to write a feminist book, it would have been impossible to study the lives of these women and their attempts to be recognized in a male-dominated profession and world, and not, in the end, create a distinctly feminist work. I find the book to be incredibly fair and kind to the men described, and yet utterly honest in describing struggles that men with similar talents and passions would not have encountered. The first story, that of Sibylline Kelly, begins in 1917. She's agreed to marry her photographer husband because they have promised each other not to live like everyone else. Sibylline occurs in the eighth story as well, although at a much later age. Their promise not to live like everyone else is soon tested by children arriving and trying to balance the lives of two already successful photographers. I don't intend even to provide a sketch of each of the eight photographers. That will be accomplished much better by reading the book. But I do want to mention a couple of the stories that particularly caught my eye due to the author's descriptions of and understanding of the political and economic issues underlying the stories. One is the story of Clara Argento, which provides a rich account of the leftist politics of the time and Whitney Otto's obvious fascination with the incredible congregation of artists and writers in Mexico City, many of them there to escape political persecution in their own countries. Clara's father's leftist politics had acquainted her with political struggles all over the world long before her eventual travels to and imprisonment in Mexico. This section of the book reminds me of Barbara Kingsolver's fascination with Mexico as a haven for liberal and leftist artists and intellectuals in her recent novel, La Lacuna, although I would say that Otto spins out her account in a less heavy-handed manner and with more attention to the sexual and artistic liberation of the community that gathered there, in addition to the political struggles. The story of Charlotte Bloom is fascinating on so many levels. It begins in March of 1927 in Berlin. The author tells us that the story begins simply from the fact that Imogene Cunningham spent a year in Dresden studying photochemistry, but that everything else in the story is spun from her imagination. Two of the characters in the story open a studio that specializes in advertising photography, and the reader is given a very plausible account of what amounts to the origins of this whole field. While I have some understanding of political events in Germany as the Brown Church came to power and the systematic persecution of, among others, gypsies, Jews, and homosexuals began, I had no idea that Berlin was a sort of countercultural mecca in many ways. Quoting from the book, one painter portrayed Berlin as the vortex of three groups: the veterans of the Great War, with their missing limbs and less visible war wounds, parked on the already crowded sidewalks; the capitalists, somehow surviving the cataclysmic cost of the war and the consequent reparations; and the prostitutes, whom one would spend the better part of an afternoon catechizing before even addressing all the sexual appetites they satisfied. There was something for everyone: lesbian, gay, transvestite, transsexual, with every category of characters and amusements. Charlotte was reminded each morning as she observed people in late-night finery on their way home, looking a little worse for wear, that the current sex industry, both its economics and its scope, was a marker of a hallowed-out nation, something that seemed to move beyond human nature. That's what it was like to be young and in Berlin in those years between the wars. Berlin made you like who you were when you were there, as if everything worth being a part of the world, all those modern ideas about sex and art and women, all that possibility was right there in its dark beating heart. Close quote. I underlined so many parts of this book, was caught by so many of the descriptions of the day-to-day lives and struggles of these women, that trying to mention each would result in a disjointed and confused muddle. Whitney Otto's account is seamless and of a whole, but don't take my word for it. Get the book and read it for yourself. I loved all the stories, and it's obvious that the author loved and admired these women. It shines forth from every page. I've been talking about Whitney Otto's novel, Eight Girls Taking Pictures. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
When I was young, the sky seemed so tall. Everything shone in the happiest sunlight.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Radio 90.7. I'm your host, Denise Morris. We'll end our program this morning with Jan Hocken interviewing Bill Ayers about his book, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And we'll have next up Clayton Morgridge reading a piece about capitalism monopoly. But let me tell you what's happening on KBOO later this morning before we go to Clayton. At 10 o'clock, we'll hear Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. And at 10:15, it's Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is journalist J.B. McKinnon. He's the author of The Once and Future World. At 11, we'll hear Disability Awareness with host Grace Eagle Reed. And I guess that looks like it for now. So we'll get back to the Old Mole and Clayton Morgridge. Thanks, Clayton.
Thank you, Denise. Well, when I was a boy, I spent whole days with my brother and neighborhood kids in long games of Monopoly. Now, that was a long time ago, but Monopoly is still played, not only as a board game, but also online, where you can play against the computer or against real people out in cyberspace. It offers children an induction into the thrills of wheeling and dealing and getting rich by driving others into bankruptcy. But does the game really represent the way capitalism works? I recently came across a talk by political philosopher Cliff Durand that inspired me to think about monopoly and capitalism and neoliberalism, and I'm using his piece as kind of a springboard. So let's think about this game. The object is to win by buying up all or most of the property around the board. Your success bankrupts the other players since they must pay you rent every time they land on your property. You drive them into destitution so they can no longer continue to play. It's a zero-sum game. What one player wins is at the expense of another. This is a game in which each person is to be guided by self-interest alone. Compassion for another player who is not doing well will simply make you vulnerable to your competitors. Now, there are a couple of ways in which Monopoly is not like real capitalism. First of all, the players begin with equal resources and opportunities. Only luck and strategic skill determines who wins. But of course, we come into the real world with very different material and cultural resources, and with very different opportunities before us. A few people will never have to really work to survive, certainly not at wage labor. Their economic activity is likely to be rather like playing Monopoly. They manipulate money and property to increase their wealth. But those born with little or nothing have no choice but to work for wages to accept whatever conditions for survival are offered by those who own the property. But this leads us to another big difference between the game and the world. In Monopoly, there is no wage labor and no workers. No money is earned by working. So there's no production. Yes, hotels and houses are said to be built, but no labor occurs in the game to build them. Just as people with money in the real world say, "I built this house or this office building," when all they really did was to direct their wealth into paying for the labor to build it. So while the absence of production and labor makes the game a very poor model of really existing capitalism, it does represent the neoliberal fantasy of the economy in which the investor makes money simply by buying property and by collecting money from others for its use. It's the same as the illusion that if everyone were a smart investor, we could all get richer and richer just by playing the stock market. Well, now, what happens when someone wins the game of Monopoly? Even though all the players start out as equals, eventually, sometimes after many hours, that equality is destroyed and everyone but the winner is bankrupt. So the game has to end, since there is no one left to buy or rent from the winner. But in the real world, people have to continue to exchange goods and services in order to survive. Economic life cannot be allowed to end. So how do we keep it from ending, really? Well, let's consider what it would take to keep the game of Monopoly going on forever. The players would have to change the Parker Brothers rules. There could be a graduated tax imposed on the players, with the proceeds going to those players in danger of bankruptcy. There could be a cap placed on the amount of property any one player could own. Now, these arrangements, of course, would violate the neoliberal premises of the game, but they do bear some resemblance to the welfare liberalism that was legislated as part of the New Deal in the Roosevelt administration following the Great Depression. At that time, millions could not pay their rent, and the capitalist ruling elite began to fear that their game was up. Welfare liberalism saved capitalism from itself. It also made life better for working people until the 1970s, when our ruling elites reverted back to the nearly naked capitalism of neoliberalism, which, like the game of Monopoly, lets each individual win or lose without any support from the community. Well, as we have noted, there's no way to make a living in Monopoly without owning property. There is no wage labor, no way to sell your productive abilities to capital, and this is a major blind spot in the game. Neoliberalism at work in the real world, of course, cannot ignore the multitude of human beings who live outside the world of financial manipulation. Real capital, unlike the play money in Monopoly, must be constantly reproduced, and that requires labor. Yet globalization and computerized automation have enabled capital to make more money while employing fewer workers and paying them less and less. Working people are falling out of the system, much like the losers in Monopoly. Weighed the 1% to give back some of what they think they have fairly won to keep losing players in the game. Radical politics, though, is about waking up to the fact that not only is the game fixed, but even if everyone did have an equal opportunity to win, most of us would still wind up losers, just as in Monopoly. What we need is a mass movement not to ask for, but to build a world organized cooperatively with the goal that all may live well. Perhaps someday our grandchildren will haul out the old Monopoly board to see what it was like in the bad old days. I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
America is waiting for a message of some sort or another.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU Radio 90.7. It's listener-supported community radio. We thank all of those who participated in our recent membership drive. Thank you for your support of KABU and for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We're going to end this morning's program with Old Mole Jan Hocken interviewing Bill Ayers about his new book, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. Jan?
Welcome to KABU, Bill Ayers.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Well, Public Enemy is Bill Ayers' second memoir after Fugitive Days, with this one covering the right-wing red-baiting of Obama during the 2008 election campaign over his association with Ayers, branded as a terrorist based on his leadership in the Weather Underground. Well, Bill Ayers, the subtitle of the book, Confessions of an American Dissident, seems a response to what you describe as kind of the relentless harassment and even persecution by the media, right-wing media particularly, and demands that you repent of the politics of the Weather Underground. Yet the subtitle seems more snide than serious. How do you see this term confessions as operating in this book, and what were you trying to achieve, particularly in defense of the politics of the Weather Underground?
Well, really, both titles, Public Enemy and the subtitle Confessions of an American Dissident, are meant to be ironic. I don't think of myself either as a public enemy nor as somebody who needs to confess anything. Everything that I've done is in the public record and well known. You know, the one thing I would say about the theme of the book, and then I'll get to the question of confessions, really, I hadn't intended to write this book until the 2008 campaign kind of thrust me into, unwillingly, into the national spotlight again as so-called, unapologetic domestic terrorist palling around with Barack Obama. But it wasn't just me, that was given that role. I mean, the narrative that was constructed to defeat Obama was a narrative that said, we don't know much about this guy. He's obviously charismatic and brilliant. But what do we know? Well, we know he has these shady friends, a fiery black nationalist preacher, a Palestinian scholar, and this terrorist. All of those were caricatures, all false. But then the real damage was the kind of guilt by association. And it's worth remembering that it was Hillary Clinton who started that narrative. It was picked up after Clinton lost. It was picked up by McCain-Palin and driven further. But it was her narrative. It was her idea, or the campaign's idea. So, I never bought it. I never thought it was, valid. But I did think it was an opportunity to dive into some of the contradictions that Fugitive Days kind of leaves behind. Fugitive Days is about the American war in Vietnam, those years, 65 to 75. This picks up in 75 and comes up to 2008. And it's really the story of, one person and how that person tries to live his life consistent with his purposes and his commitments in a changing landscape and over many, many years. So it's a lot about teaching and parenting, as well as about activism in, you know, kind of quieter times. But the confessions part is simply this, that I there's a long tradition in literature of confessions, and they're rarely meant literally. But yes, I've been asked again and again to say the Weather Underground somehow went off the rails in a way that was so severe that, you know, that we owe a big apology, a big general apology. And I get into this in the book a little bit in terms of saying, look, part of the reason the Weather Underground and the Vietnam War continue to animate so much interest in this country is we've never gotten over it. Why have we never gotten over it? Because we've never even tried to tell the truth about it. And so I call in the book for a truth and reconciliation process, recognizing that the truth is not an end point, but it's a quest, and we've never gone on that quest to understand what that genocidal war was about and why those of us who opposed it, even when we broke the law, even when we went off the rails, even when we made bad mistakes, we're on the right side of history and on the right side of humanity.
There's one very clever passage where you describe having a speaking engagement canceled because of your role, leadership role in the Weather Underground, and that you could be you could speak if you made a public declaration renouncing violence, and you responded that, well, if all the other speakers at this university similarly renounce their history of violence, you would do as well, which I think gets to the point of the role of red baiting, but also the hypocrisy of this these demands for confessions, including within the Democratic Party as well as within the right.
I point out in that passage that if everyone else does it, that's fine, because I've never been a huge advocate for violence, and I don't know where that's coming from exactly, except for the stereotypical kind of presentations. But I said, if you demand that of every speaker, look who you won't be able to have at the University of Colorado. The president, any of the cabinet members, your two senators, your congressmen, and I could go right down the list, because none of them have renounced violence as a way to make political change. In fact, all of them participate in it.
Well, let's turn to the critiques from the left, because I think in the 60s and 70s, as now, there are different visions of what it means to be a radical or revolutionary. We, as an Old Mole collective, really focus on democracy from below, broad-based organizing, finding common grounds in moving toward a transformative politics. And the weather underground, and setting aside the whole question of violence and the right of armed resistance, the politics of the Weather Underground were very sectarian, even in the context of its times. How do you look back now on the strategies at the time when Students for a Democratic Society, where you had and Bernadette Dorn had leadership roles, kind of broke with that organization and calling for bringing the war home and armed resistance to the state? Well, how do you look back on the politics within the left? Because I think it's easy to just deal with the right and the hypocrisy and the agenda there. But I think a different, more difficult question, perhaps, in dealing with the politics of the left.
Yeah, you're certainly right. And I was an officer of SDS and a member of SDS from the mid-1960s on. And what you describe as the Old Mole politics were very much the politics of SDS, participatory democracy, democracy from below, mass organizing, real change coming from when the masses of people themselves rise up and demand real change, whatever tactics are used. So we were very much in that tradition. Here's the problem. As the 60s wore on, as the war in Vietnam wore on, really, I was first arrested in 1965 opposing that war in a nonviolent direct action sit-in in a draft board, and then arrested many, many times over the next 3 years. We thought in the spring of 68 that we had won the battle and that the war in Vietnam would end. Of course, that proved to be false. The war in Vietnam did not end. And that presented not just a crisis for democracy, but a crisis for the anti-war movement. And even within my own family, one of my brothers joined the Democratic Party and tried to build a peace wing. One went to the factories, one went to the communes, and I did what I did. I don't think any one of us had a purchase on the right idea, nor was any one of us completely crazy. We were facing the fact that the war, our simplest goal, which was to end the war, could not be achieved and was not achieved. So for 10 years, the war ground on. Every year, every week that the war went on, 6,000 people were murdered. How do you stop it? And we definitely, I'll get turned from that and say we definitely, we in SDS, we in the Weather Underground, made a turn towards sectarianism. And not just SDS, the mobilization for peace turned towards sectarianism. The Black Liberation Movement turned towards sectarianism. These were the times that kind of challenged us to come up with the right way forward. I think that our greatest sin, I'll put it that way since we're in confession mode, our greatest problem was sectarianism and dogmatism. It didn't last forever, but it did last long enough to do real damage. And the one regret I really do have from that period is not kind of the spectacular opposition to the war and the destruction of property, which is frankly all we did, kind of high-scale vandalism with a lot of rhetoric. But the real problem is that we mistook, friends for enemies, that we isolated ourselves in what I refer to in the book as the well-lit prison of a single good idea. That was our real mistake, and that's something I've regretted for ever since and tried to learn from ever since.
You know, in reading your book, and you get a sense of throughout the book of you as a wonderful and committed father who led a challenging and in many ways a rich life with your partner and comrade Bernadette Dorn and raising kids and how life goes on underground and how you also came out of that and had a successful career as a university professor, and many of the Weather Underground survived in ways that, of course, the Black Panthers and other groups that came up against the state did not fare so well. But it's only very late in the book, I think page 176, that I think some of that wisdom that you're expressing now comes through, and most of the book seems to be really, I think, taking up this sense, and rightfully so, of persecution by the right. What do you see given the romance of the outlaw that you acknowledge as part of the Weather Underground and the interest among young radicals in that movement, the responsibility to really, as you say, not just confess, but learn in a deep way from the costs, the political decisions of that era, particularly in tactics that left so many people behind because they were so risky.
You know, I guess I want to take up three or four things in what you just said. First of all, you're absolutely right that Black radicals suffered in ways that white radicals didn't in the aggregate. But it's not true to say that the Black Panther folks were all wiped out. Many of them became university professors as well. Think Kathleen Cleaver, but that's only one. Many, many people went on to successful careers in academia and stayed true to their values and their commitments and their activism. And I would put Kathleen in that camp, but I can name dozens if you were interested. And similarly, it's not true that no white radicals suffered the fate that many others did. David Gilbert, my dear friend and comrade and the father of my adopted child, is still in prison. And that's a terrible injustice, as are several of the Black comrades. So
yeah, and I also think that's not a fair charge against white radicals. Of course, there's racism in how radicals are
yeah,
prosecuted.
We're
yes,
we're agreeing about
right.
that.
Right, I agree. That's not
but
a central point.
The other thing is I do not think most of the book is taken up with the persecution of the right. I tend not to be a whiny person. This book is not a manifesto, and it's not even a biography or a history or an autobiography. It's a memoir, so it's really a narrative about a life. And obviously I select certain incidents and anecdotes to highlight because that's how I think of it and I remember it. But I think what's important that you're asking me to turn to is what have we learned and what can we pass on? I don't think the learnings have to do with tactics, and I don't think our tactics were as, you know, I mean, I know that we're held up as kind of the poster child of a certain kind of turn to violence. Yeah, you know, I don't completely buy it, and I'll tell you why. Two reasons, really. One is if you look at the left worldwide in the late 60s, early 70s, you will see a turn to terrorism on the part of groups, group after group after group, in Europe and in Latin America, and that's not what we did. We didn't turn to terrorism. We didn't kill people. We intentionally set about not to kill people. And when we went underground, there were literally dozens of other groups underground, the most famous being the Madison group that accidentally killed that researcher at Army Math, and that was a catastrophe for the left. But of all, you know, the FBI says that over a three-year period in the early 70s, there were between 20 and 30,000 anti-war bombings in this country. The Weather Underground took credit for 24. We also took credit for disarming a whole lot of people who were bent on the bigger the mess, the better. So I wouldn't go down the road of saying the tactic is the thing that distinguished us. How else to say this? I think that you and I agree today, and one of the lessons should always be that if you want to be a radical and an activist, and I urge people to be radical activists, radical meaning going to the heart of the matter, going to the base of things, understanding not just this war or that war, but understanding what causes war. Go to the root, find out what causes things, and then act against injustice. But as an activist, there's a simple rhythm. We have to open our eyes. We have to be astonished at everything we see, both the good and the bad of it. We have to act, and then we have to doubt. The Weather Underground lost track of the doubt part. And without doubting, you become dogmatic. With dogmatism comes certainty. With certainty becomes self-righteousness. And then everything goes downhill from there. So that's one of the lessons I want to teach. The second is, I think that there's a pedagogical, at the risk of being a lifelong teacher, there's a pedagogical standard by which to judge your actions. And you can't always judge them in advance. The pedagogical standard is, I'm going to act. Did I learn, and did I teach?
Well, you
don't always
know
that in advance.
And of course, the Weather Underground title was taken from a Bob Dylan song,
right.
Of course, that you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows, but you certainly may have needed a climatologist to read the sentiments of the political. Political climate of the 60s, and we can take up some of these same questions again here on the Old Mole because we share a vision of revolutionary politics from the ground up, and that sounds like what you're trying to emphasize
today.
Bill Ayers, author of Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident, will be speaking at Powell's Books, downtown, this Thursday, October 31st at 7:30 p.m., and you can speak with him there after his talk. Thanks so much.
Come in costume.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour, and this has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. You'll find this show and a number of archived shows to go through and listen to over and over again. Thanks to our folks who helped during the membership drive recently, helping the KBOO community and the Old Mole Variety Hour. It is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday. I want to thank our guests this morning, Trish Kozla, Bill Ayers, and our contributors Jan Hawken, Clayton Morgridge, and Bill Resnick. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week.
The listening public, the other point of view.
There was a strong sense that this was the beginning of something that would spread across the country.
On Sunday, November 3rd, at the historic Hollywood Theater, KBOO presents an exclusive benefit screening of the film KPFA On the Air.
This documentary tells the powerful story of the beginnings of listener-sponsored radio in the United States with the birth of Pacifica in Berkeley in 1949.
KPFA On the Air chronicles the origins of the free speech movement, the first stirrings of the student movements at Berkeley, and opposition to the Vietnam War in the early 1960s.
Eventually spawning a network of free-form, independent radio stations across the country, including KBOO, which came on the air in 1968. So come join us at the Hollywood Theater, Northeast 41st and Sandy Boulevard, Sunday, November 3rd, at 7 in the evening.
Help keep community radio strong and thriving into the future.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, October 28th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web. And it's your community radio because you make this happen. Your support that you so generously, this last full membership drive, you so generously devoted to this station makes us strong.